Okay, beloved friends, this is Dr. Jim Bertel coming to you live from my home here in Maumelle, Arkansas, and today we're privileged to have Reverend Mike Smith with us from the Country Bible Church in Brenham, Texas, and again, he's back again. Mike, good morning, sir.
Good morning to you, Dr. Jim. Thank
yes,
you.
Sir. I'm doing just fine. How was your church service yesterday?
It was great. We had a good service, and the weather doesn't have that much really to do with a church service,
mm-hmm.
but yesterday was a particularly crisp day. It had rained the day before, and it was just so sharp, and the people were eager. It was a great service.
Yeah, well, that's good. Mike, I was at, Janet and I normally go out on Sunday morning after the service with a couple of friends. We go out to lunch together, but they were out of town yesterday, and so I had the privilege of tuning into the program, and your Gospel in the Stars. I'm not quite sure how you label that. I labeled it the Gospel in the Stars. I think I remember you talking about that years ago when I first learned about this, and we were able to log in yesterday to hear your service.
Oh, I'm glad you did.
Yes, sir. Let me see now. Website, sir, and an email address.
Okay, the website is www.countrybiblechurch.us, and email address is mike44gv@gmail.com.
And your book is in progress, and that's what we're going through right now. We're in chapter 2 of Tolerating Tyranny. Just curiously, is it any closer to, well, I guess it is probably one day closer today than to publication, but how soon do you expect to have it published?
Well, I really hesitate to set a date.
Okay.
Because when I do that at church, I'll say, well, we only have maybe two more days left in this session, in this series,
mm-hmm.
and it winds up being 2 weeks, so... I'm not sure.
Yes.
I was on vacation for a couple of weeks there, which I wasn't able to work on it, but I'm going to really concentrate on it mm-hmm. now and hopefully have it to the final editor within hopefully a couple of weeks, maybe.
I understand. Well, listen, Mike, just curiously, we've been dealing with your book now for several weeks, and question that comes up in my mind right now is, what is it that prompted you to write this?
Well, actually, I taught a series that I entitled Romans 13.
Oh.
And this was, I guess, now nearly a couple years ago. And what prompted me to do that was because I saw so many people that thought they were curtailed by the Bible, that they were hindered from standing up for their freedom,
mm-hmm.
that they had the wrong idea, that they thought that the Bible required them to unconditionally submit to government. And so I went to the Scriptures, and I started seeing that that's not really what the Scriptures say. In fact, it says just the opposite.
Mm-hmm.
And so I was about a year, maybe a little over a year, teaching that Romans 13 and conveying essentially some of the principles that I have in the book. Then when I was finished, some folks said, well, won't you turn that into a book? And so I thought, okay, I'll do that. And I started out trying to keep the same format that I had taught in Romans 13, but very quickly I saw that wasn't going to work. There was just too much information to try to keep that format. So I just scrapped that and started from scratch.
Mm-hmm.
And I started writing this. I've written about a dozen booklets that I have in the church.
Mm-hmm.
This is the first full-length book that I've written.
Okay.
And I had no idea how long it took, how much time it would take,
yes,
and
sir.
How hard it would be.
No, I understand.
It's been a learning experience for me.
Yes. And Mike, your publisher will be whom?
I'm going to self-publish it, is what I have in mind right now. I started mm-hmm. out going to, I think I had three or four different publishers that I sent it to.
Yeah.
And they read it, and all of them were eager to publish it. But for one thing, it was very expensive, and I didn't know how...
Mm-hmm.
I didn't know if that was the best way to go. And then the Lord opened the door to a lady up in New York that not only is a great editor, but she could take me through the process of self-publishing it. She had done it herself.
Yes.
And so I decided to go that route. At least that's where I am right now.
Yeah, Mike, when I published my first book, Christianity and Spiritual Perspective, I sent it to the Southern Baptist Press, and it was going to cost me $3,000, but there was a special that week, and it was going to run get reduced to about $2,600. And when I sent my manuscript to the editor, they rejected it. They rejected it on three doctrinal issues. And I thought that was interesting because I come out of a Southern Baptist background. We're very conservative, and yet it was rejected. So they sent my money back, and that's when I located Create Space to be able to do it myself. And so I published the book myself through Create Space. I didn't publish it, but I sent it to Create Space, and it cost me about $2.97 a book, and.
Well, I was. That's one of the publishers that I had sent it to that read it and is willing to publish it.
Yeah.
And there were three other. Excuse me. I was going to only Christian publishers.
Yes.
But when I was looked at into that, that was over a year ago. It ranged anywhere from $3,500 minimum to over $7,000.
To Create Space?
No, all the different.
Oh, yes, okay, sure, publishers. I understand, yeah. Well, I tell you, I'm amazed today at what we can do, and it's professional when it gets done, and I'm sure that that's the way it'll be with yours, too. How many booklets do you say you have?
About a dozen that I keep in the church. When I wrote these, I call them booklets,
mm-hmm.
Is because they're small enough to fit in a woman's purse or in the pocket of a shirt.
Sure, sure.
Some of them may be a little larger than that, but the reason I did that was because these days people don't read that much.
Absolutely.
And if you give them a little booklet, they're more apt to read it, and they can take it with them. It's handy to carry. And so I thought this is the way to go, because people usually don't read a book that's a 100-page book. For a lot of people these days, they won't even consider it.
Absolutely. Well, Mike, how did you publish those? And the reason I'm asking these questions, and we haven't gotten into your booklet yet, the reason I'm asking this is because we may have other people out here, pastors and others, who will hear this, who have a desire to publish and don't have a clue as to how to go about it. How did you publish your little booklets?
I don't know. I don't guess they're actually published. What we did was just take what I had on the computer and gave it to copiers here in Brenham.
Gotcha.
One I had done in Austin, and just essentially had them copies made. We had We usually have about anywhere from 300 to 500 at a time made.
Yes.
And just at a copier.
I got you. Okay. And then crop them. Is that right?
I'm sorry, go ahead.
And then have them cropped, or does your the printer do that for you?
Oh, they do the whole thing.
Is that right?
Yeah, they make it the right size, and they crop it, and they do the folding and the staples.
Oh, yes, okay. Well, just curiously, how are they bound? Are they stapled or what?
They're stapled.
Okay.
I guess none of them are over 30 pages long.
You understand?
And so that's actually, when you fold them,
mm-hmm.
It's like 15 pages.
Sure enough.
And when they're that small, it's not that hard to do.
Yeah, and if they're folded like that, it might only be about maybe 8 or 9 pages.
Right.
You're printing on 4 sides. Yeah. Okay.
Right. Mm-hmm.
Okay. Well, listen. Let's move on then. One more thing. Just curiously, you went to Galveston for a vacation?
Right. Galveston, Texas.
Did you enjoy it?
Oh, I loved it. Yeah, it was great.
Okay.
It was a getaway, and we had, we were out, I guess it was a hotel, our condo, it had a kitchen and so forth in it, and we were up on the second floor, and the only thing separating us from the Gulf of Mexico was the main seawall drive there, which was the road, and we could look out and see the ocean and see mm-hmm. the pelicans flying over, and the tankers way out in the distance, and the shrimp shrimp.
Yeah.
It was just a real delight.
Did you get into the water at all?
Oh yeah.
Oh, okay. All right.
Yeah, I got out there. The waves, I like to go when it's rough because I like to play in the waves, and it was pretty good.
Okay. Well, listen, back to the book, Ben. Back Ben Ramsey relates his perception. Just introduce it whatever way you want to and go on.
Okay, well, Dr. Ramsey was a field surgeon during the First War of Independence, which most people call the Revolutionary mm-hmm. War, but it really wasn't a revolution. And he was a leader of the Senate. And 18 years after the Declaration of Independence was signed, he gave an oration. And we are we're about in the fifth paragraph
mm-hmm.
That I have recorded in my book, explaining how things were then. And the reason I included this Dr. Ramsey in his oration is to show how things were just 18 years after the Declaration of Independence was signed, and how wonderful things were then, and juxtaposing those to the way things are now. So, I'll just pick it up there.
Mm-hmm.
Ramsey relates his perception of their leaders. This would be the colonists after mm-hmm. they won their independence.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm quoting him. Such are the effects of government formed on equal principles that men in authority cannot easily forget that they are the servants of the community over which they preside. Excuse me. Our rulers, taken from the people and at stated periods returning to them, have the strongest incitement to make the public will their guide and the public good their end.
Mm.
Now, before I go on and explain some of the comments that I have here,
mm-hmm.
anyone that's hearing this has to be stricken by the difference of how things are today. The leaders, he's saying our rulers that are taken from the people have the strongest incitement to make the public will their guide and the public good their end.
Mm-hmm.
But Dr. Jim, how many of our politicians, whether they're in the Senate or whether they're in the House,
mm-hmm.
How many, and of course the president and his administration as well, how many of those would fit that description?
Mike, quite honestly, I don't know that I know any that have been there for a while. I'm not quite sure whether maybe Ted Cruz and a couple of others at this point in time might fit that description, but they've only been there a short time. I would just hope that they would hold up.
It would be safe to say just a handful.
Oh, absolutely.
Yeah, just very few. And for someone to, a great man like Dr. Ramsey, to give an oration like that today would be laughed off the stage.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, that's how far things have gone.
Yeah.
And it's unfortunate, but anyway, I'll continue.
Well, no, before we go on, I've got a question that's been looming in my mind for quite some time, and it's sort of beginning to gel, and I'd sort of like to run it by you in terms of freedom. Dr. Ramsey made this kind of a comment, and I agree with that 100%. Now, I want to ask a question to go something like this, and if you need for me to clarify the question, please say so. But we have today people who call themselves conservative. And I believe that when Ramsey says here, they have the strongest incitement to make the public will their guide and the public good their end. I want to ask, how much should a person in the House of Representatives or in the Senate, when they go to Washington, D.C., how much should they go believing that it's their responsibility to do something for their constituency? In other words, we get this idea of political the compassionate conservative. Now, that to me is almost like an oxymoron. So, how much should your representatives, should your senators in Texas, going to Congress, how much should they do for you? What should they do for you, Mike?
I don't think their mission is to go and do anything for you.
Hello.
Excuse me. I think that their job is to protect your freedom, number one. And the idea that they're going to Congress, whichever state they may be coming mm-hmm. from, and their goal is to do good things for the people, unfortunately, that's the mindset that many people have today, and they think, well, I'm going to vote for the man that's going to do the most for me.
Yes.
That's who they vote on. They
yes.
think, I have, if they are very concerned about foreign affairs, then the government, I mean, the senator or congressman that has the, will do the most for them in that area, that's who they're going to vote for. Or they might be, let's say, pro-abortion, and they think, well, I'm going to vote for the guy that has the best reputation for standing for abortion. And there might be someone that, well, for me, it's the economy. And they go on and on, and they think they vote in terms of this. My criteria is which one of these people who are running for office mm-hmm. is going to absolutely stick with the Constitution mm-hmm. and make sure that they don't go beyond it yeah. and protect my rights, because that's their duty. That's what mm-hmm. I think they
yeah,
do.
That's my contention also, 100%. Then why is it that you believe that the majority of people then in our country are not of that same frame of mind? Because when these guys go to Congress, when they go to Washington, D.C., when they get sworn in, they put their hand on a Bible, and they swear to uphold the Constitution. And that just, it just seems to go in one ear and out the other as far as the constituency out here goes.
I think that, I hate to say this, but I think it's true. I think to the great majority of men and women who take that oath, to them, it's just a formality.
Absolutely,
it means nothing to them because they've run on an agenda in order to get the most they can from the federal government or from mm-hmm. the state government, whichever. And they've already made that clear. And the people elected them, and they think they have a mandate from the people. All right, you're going up there now. You get our mm-hmm. spot at the federal or state feed trough. And make sure we get our fair share. And when you go in with that attitude mm-hmm. and you take the oath of office, then that's why I say I think it's nothing more than a formality, because yeah. immediately they forget about it and start carrying out their agenda.
So that even when they're running for as a candidate, their promises are against our Constitution. Would you say that's true?
Absolutely. It's shameful.
Jeez.
When I saw the last gubernatorial election here in Texas,
mm-hmm.
there were several of them. I don't know, it seemed like 8 or 10 of them, and they were in a debate.
Yes.
Every one of them seemed to be, there might have been one or two at the most,
mm-hmm.
That weren't saying, now you elect me, and this is what I'm going to do for you.
Yeah.
And this is how I promise you, I'm going to get more federal aid than all the rest of these guys put together.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
And that's what they're running on. And you know, over and over, you've heard me say that people get the government they deserve.
No, absolutely.
The people, and that's what the people want. They don't want to hear someone say, well, I'm not going to try to get any federal aid whatsoever because that's not what we're about. I'm going to make sure that your rights are defended. I'm going to mm-hmm. make sure that the Constitution mm-hmm. is actually upheld. That type of person, unfortunately, these days wouldn't have a chance to be elected yeah. because the people have gotten used to having Uncle Sam be Uncle Sugar Daddy.
Sure. Well, since we who live out or maybe reside outside of Texas, is there anything? And maybe, just to your best of your knowledge, is there anything about Ted Cruz that we ought to know that doesn't seem to jive with what we think he is as a conservative?
Well, when Ted Cruz was running for governor, he, in my estimation, he blew away all the candidates. They weren't even in his league.
Is that right?
Yes, he was very articulate. he was he wasn't condescending to the people.
Yeah.
He knew the facts. And then later on, this was, I think, it was sometime this year, early in the year, there was a prayer breakfast at West Houston Bible Church that I attended, and Rafael Cruz, which is Senator Ted Cruz's father, was the main speaker there.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
And I learned a lot from him. By the way, he was a great speaker. He was the guy that was under Fidel Castro. He's from Cuba.
Mm-hmm,
and
mm-hmm.
He thought Fidel Castro was going to be great until he actually got in.
Yes, I understand.
Became a communist, and this is when Rafael started to rebel against what was going on. They threw him in prison. He was able to get out of prison, and he came to the United States, and he was talking about his son, Ted. There was, I think, three boys. This is when he was in high school that were a member of some organization. I can't remember the name of it. But they would go to Rotaries and Lions Club and these different organizations,
mm-hmm.
and they would speak. But what they would do is when they would go, there would always be a dinner before they got up to speak. And while they were eating, these three boys would put up three big blackboards. And each one of those boys were writing out the Constitution by memory.
Oh, my.
Each one would have a third of the Constitution. So he had already in high school, he had the Constitution memorized.
Wow, wow, yeah.
And the values and the way that Rafael had raised him said a great deal. And that, as he has become senator now, yeah, I think it's becoming obvious that these values and these attributes that his daddy instilled in him are still there.
Boy, 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 that brings tears to my eyes. Goodness gracious.
So he's, of course, he's a man. He can be fallible, and certainly under the pressure that he's under and in that pit of vipers up there, it's easy to be tainted, but he just needs our prayers to hold the line.
Mike, let me ask you another question that's been on my mind for a long time, and that is that if a person understands our Constitution, they wouldn't have to understand the Bible at this point in time to understand freedom, but they understood our Constitution and took a stand on freedom outlined in our Constitution, how much of a Christian does that person have to be in order to be a freedom-oriented individual?
Well, I don't think you have to be a Christian at all.
Okay.
To be freedom-oriented,
mm-hmm.
I think that if you are a Christian and you know the Bible, then you're going to be a much stronger,
yes, absolutely,
mm-hmm. individual,
yes.
Knowing what backing up.
Mm-hmm.
Actually, it's the Constitution that backs up the Bible, and
mm-hmm.
not the other way around.
Yes,
but still, in the Constitution itself, if you understand this, if you know something about our history, then you will not be easily duped. You
mm-hmm.
will be those people that are independent thinkers and not thinking like slaves. They're able to make decisions on their own and think for themselves and not be manipulated by the media and the government government line that
mm-hmm.
That actually is what the media is giving. They're
sure
just
enough.
Parroting what that comes from there. And if you do that, then you're going to be ostracized and you're going to be looked at as a wacko and a
yep.
weirdo.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
But that's okay, in my opinion.
Oh, absolutely.
To be free in your thinking, and of course, whether you're going to understand and accept the Bible, whether you're going to understand and accept the Constitution, if you understand and accept the Declaration of Independence and the Bill of Rights, all
yes.
these things instill in a person a spirit of independence and freedom.
Yes.
It's not rebellion. Today, what have you think that you just have a spirit of rebellion? No, they don't understand that we are the ones sovereign, not the government.
Yes.
And so I think, excuse me, does that kind of answer your question?
Absolutely, absolutely. And I was, so, Mike, yesterday morning, I was so so impressed to go back and read a portion of the Declaration of Independence again to our people in the Sunday morning service, in order to help us to understand when do we have a revolution? When do we exert our will to bring about a change in this government and get back to where we were again, where we were when we started? And I'm telling you, the Declaration of Independence is just an absolutely phenomenal document.
Oh, it is phenomenal.
Yeah,
mm-hmm. I agree. It's it actually turned the world upside down in the thinking of the divine right of kings, that king is actually acting on God's behalf.
Mm-hmm.
Of course, it could be not even a believer; it could be a despot. But this was the manner of thinking for our founding fathers and these colonies to support the Declaration of Independence, recognizing that our rights come from God and
yes.
not from any man.
Yeah.
That just turned the world upside down. And of course, this is biblical. These men were scholars; they
yeah.
were very intelligent, and they were also, most of them, were Christians.
Yes, yes.
They had
yeah.
the Judeo-Christian ethic.
Yes.
And they had seen what was going on in England and the persecution and so forth. And so when they came over here, it wasn't just to make more money and to be entrepreneurs. For the most part, it was to have religious freedom.
Yeah, absolutely. Well, listen. Sorry for all that, all my questions and everything.
No apology there. I think that one reason that I enjoyed your tolerating tyranny services is because of the commentary.
Okay.
I mean, this because all I'm giving here is a basic foundational.
Absolutely.
Structure, kind of like a skeleton, and as we go through this, we can put meat on it.
Yes, absolutely.
As we go through and embellish these points, and it's just great to have someone like yourself to bounce these things off, and the dialogue,
yes.
I think, is
okay.
terrific.
Well, thank you, sir. Well, let's move on then, the Founding Fathers.
Okay, the Founding Fathers had differing backgrounds, such as farmers, merchants, financiers, scientists, doctors, and other occupations that they returned to after their congressional sessions ended. They were in touch with the people they represented and did not sequester themselves in granite Capitol buildings. I started to put ivory towers there.
Okay.
Today, career politicians have become the norm. An example is former Senator Robert Byrd from West Virginia, who was a U.S. representative for 6 years and a U.S. senator for 51 years.
Goodness.
One can acquire tremendous power and influence over such a long period that could easily cause a person to forget he is the servant and not the master of the people. And, you know, I was thinking about recently when Senator Ted Cruz gave that that speech, I don't know what you call it, an oration, or I don't know if it was a, what do they call it,
when he did the 21 hours?
Right.
Yeah.
When he did that. Well, he got a lot of grief from people in the Senate, some of these good old boys that have been in there for decades, and they said he had no right to do that because he was just a rookie. He hadn't really served his time, and he
yeah.
didn't have any right to do something like that.
Yes, yeah.
Well, anytime someone stands up for what they believe is right and has the courage of their convictions, it doesn't matter whether they're a rookie. In fact, it was good that he was, you could say, new to the Senate because he didn't have all those years to be tainted like they were. And
yeah.
so... The problem is once you have people that are in there that long, they have tremendous power because I've learned recently that it is the time spent in the Senate or the Congress that gives you the qualification to be on these committees
mm-hmm.
and to be a chairman of the committee, you have to be there so many years, and it's all has to do with seniority. And it shouldn't be that way, but that's the way it is. And these guys that have been there long enough to see really how the game is played, people like Harry Reid, they use that power, and it has nothing to do with the character of the person or what they've accomplished. It just has to do with seniority. I see it something like what they have in education. Once a professor has been at a particular university for so long, then he's able to get tenure. And I know you know a lot about education. You could probably speak to this better than I can. But personally, I just think that no one should have tenure, that they every day they go to a class, every year that they spend as a professor, depends on what they're doing at that time. I mean, it's kind of like a path that you really don't have to perform anymore.
Absolutely. I agree, Mike. I don't think there should be any... I don't think tenure should be out. It shouldn't exist. And you ought to be required to do your duty and meet whatever criteria there is there. And the truth of the matter is that somewhere along the line you may get fired. But isn't it interesting that if they were born again Christians and got fired under that situation, they'd realize that the grace of God is sufficient and there'd be something else out there just as good or better.
Absolutely. In fact, you could wear that as a badge of honor.
Yes, that's right.
If you were a professor at, say, Berkeley out in California, and you were determined to teach something that was biblical, and it's a liberal school, and they said, no, you can't do it, and they fired you over it, well, I would wear that as a badge of honor.
Hello.
That I got fired for standing up for what is right, especially from a school like that.
That's exactly right.
And a lot of people, a lot of these professors are so happy when they reach tenure because the character of the person has nothing to do with it. And it's the same thing in the Congress. I'm relating this to the people in the Congress. It doesn't have to do with how well they represented the Constitution. Doesn't have anything to do with the integrity and character that they demonstrated over a number of years. All that makes one qualified to have more power to be on these committees or to be the chairman of a committee is how much time have you served.
That's right.
And most of them get reelected over and over because they've given the people what they want, which is not freedom and independence, but boondoggles. They've given them all these things that are unconstitutional because the purpose of the government isn't to give the people anything. The purpose of the government is to keep them free so that they can produce for themselves.
Agreed, 100%.
So, anyway, this is just, I think, unconscionable that someone could be in there for 51 years. I know Mark Levine, in his book, The Liberty Amendment, has as one of his... proposed amendment is the term limits, that they would limit senators and congressmen to a certain period of time, and then someone else would be able to take over.
I think he said 12 years.
Yeah, 12 years. And, you know, the 17th Amendment plays a part in this as well.
Absolutely.
Because once they changed the senators from being appointed by the Congress to being elected by the people, it just really fosters the idea that now they are independent. They don't have to really represent the people. And this is what we were looking at in the paragraph above. Their job is to represent the people. Now, they do have to stand with their own conscience, but the people who sent them there, if the congressman or senator was truthful and said, this is what I stand for, it would be in line with what the people were wanting anyway, what they wanted them to do. And so there wouldn't be any tension between what their conscience says and what the people had sent them to do.
Sure.
The only problem now is they are making decisions and their conscience does go along with what the people sent them there to do, but the people aren't sending them there to keep them free and independent, but to get all the government largesse they possibly can.
Absolutely. And Mark Levin not only recommended that term limits for both the House of Representatives and also for the senators, but to we want to get rid of the 17th Amendment and go back to electing them to the Senate in Washington D.C. by the Senate in the state electing them. And the interesting thing is if they get up there and do something that is contrary to what the people want, they could actually get the Senate in the state could vote to get rid of them and bring them back.
Yeah, well, they could. What originally all they had to do was essentially dismiss them and appoint someone else.
Absolutely,
because they were appointed. They weren't even elected by the
yes.
states. They were appointed. So once they started getting away from what they sent them there for,
mm-hmm.
Then they could say they wouldn't have to wait 6 years to the end of their term. They could jerk them out of there right away and get someone else in there that are more in line with what the people
absolutely.
Want.
Absolutely. Ooh, glory, I tell you. Oh.
People don't understand how important that is.
Yeah.
All these shenanigans that are going on right now with the Senate, that wouldn't even exist if they hadn't passed the 17th Amendment. And I agree. I think it should be repealed immediately.
You know, interestingly enough, though, someone raised the question when I brought this up to someone the other day. They said, "Well, you know, aren't they going to be just as corrupt on the state level as they are on the federal level, and hey, everything is going to go along the same." Well, in Arkansas, when I came to Arkansas, there was no Republican Party. It was all Democrat. That's just the way it was. But since that time, the Republican Party has grown, and now our Congress in Arkansas is basically Republican. So we could get them out of there in a hurry.
Well, yeah, the House of Representatives is traditionally closer to the people. The people have a closer
mm-hmm.
relationship with them, and so they are able to reflect the will of the people more than the Senate is,
mm-hmm.
because they aren't House of Representatives, Congressmen, aren't they in for, is it 2 years?
2 years.
2 years, and the Senate for 6 years, so you can see there's quite a bit of difference.
Oh, wait,
by
sure.
the way, have you ever explained to the folks how we came up with the House of Representatives and Senate, how that all came about?
No, I did not.
Well, if you'd like, I would explain that
do
a little
it.
Bit. It might be helpful.
Hey, you do it.
Well, when they were coming up with the Constitution, there was a problem because there were some of the small states that had a lower population,
mm-hmm.
and some of the larger states, of course, had, as far as population goes, and if you just had a vote of the population, then there would be, the small states would essentially be left out of the picture. And they were resisting that, and they weren't going to go along with it. So they came up with a idea. Okay, well, why don't we have two houses? One will be based on population, which is the House of Representatives, and then we're going to have another house, which we'll call the Senate, and we'll just have two senators from each state. So each state has equal representation in the Senate because each has two senators, and the House of Representatives will be disproportioned from one state to another because of the population. And then when you have a House and you have a Senate, and for a bill to be passed, it has to pass both the House and the Senate. Then it came about where people were, everybody agreed and were happy with it. So that's how we came up with a House of Representatives and a Senate based on that idea. Are you there?
Okay. Yes, sir. I had muted my microphone just long enough to blow my nose.
Okay. Well, I just went. I can hear just a least bit of background sound. And when I was finished, I didn't hear anything. So I don't know if
you're absolutely,
I had
you're absolutely right. Yes.
Okay. Anyway, I thought that might be helpful for folks to
yes,
recognize
sir.
How it came about. Mm-hmm. Okay. Back then, Ramsey said, it is one of the peculiar privileges we enjoy in consequence of independence that no individual, no party interest, no foreign influence can plunge us into war. This is very important also. He goes on to say, think of the cruel war now carrying on by kings and nobles against the equal rights of man. Call to mind the slaughtered thousands whose blood is daily shedding on the plains of Europe. And let your daily tribute of thanks ascend to the common parent, capital C, capital P,
mm-hmm.
of the universe, and I have in brackets here, of course, he's talking about God,
yes.
who, in capital W there, who has established you in a separate government, exempt from participating in these hard scenes. And then he goes on, he's saying, that's not him.
Mm-hmm, yeah.
Mm-hmm. Had the colonists remained in Europe, they would have been conscripted to fight, not to defend their country, but because their king had an argument or dispute with another king.
Mm-hmm.
But since the new government was established on God's principles, those in the new world were exempt from fighting horrendous wars for frivolous reasons.
Jeez.
They kept their focus on protecting their own country from foreign attack and their noses in their own business.
Now, you're talking here about the United States when he talks about, but since the new government, that's
right.
our government here in this country.
Right. Yeah.
Yes, sir.
Absolutely. And just think of all, I don't know how far to take, but let me read the next paragraph
sure.
and I'll make a comment.
Okay.
The founders knew well the horrible suffering and financial ruin that occurs when one man has the power to thrust a nation into war. That is why Article 1, Section 8, was included in the Constitution, which requires a declaration of war from Congress before going to war.
Mm-hmm.
And if you think about, if we just stop and think about this for a moment, World War II was the last war we were in where a declaration of war was made.
Mm-hmm.
When you got into the Korean War, there was no declaration of war from the Congress, and they tried to evade the issue and try to sidestep this Article 1, Section 8 in the Constitution by calling it a police action. Now, that was totally absurd. This was a war. It
yes.
lasted several years, and you had two armies clashing, and yet they called it a police action. And by calling it that, they thought, well, this will ameliorate the people. The people will be all right with this. Because it's not a war, it's just a police act.
Yeah.
And they got by with it. And then you had the Vietnam War, and the Vietnam War, what was it, 40,000 casualties?
Something like
40,000 dead, mm-hmm. something like that.
Mm-hmm.
And by then, they didn't call it a police action. They thought, well, the people, it's like boiling the frog that you always
yep.
are speaking
mm-hmm.
of. The people they let the first war go without a declaration. Now we don't even have to call it a police action. We'll just do it. And that war went on, and they said, I heard on the History Channel just the other day, that war came to a stalemate. Well, I beg to differ. I think that we just lost that war.
Mm-hmm,
it had
mm-hmm.
nothing to do with the brave soldiers that were fighting it. It had everything to do with the president and the Congress and everybody meddling in, and it was all politics. But again, the idea is that there was no declaration of war made there either. And then in all the conflicts that we've had since then, if you remember Desert Storm or under Bush
mm-hmm.
Sr.,
mm-hmm.
he went to the United Nations to get approval. He didn't even bother going to the Congress for a declaration of war.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And then we had the Iraq War, and then we had the war in Afghanistan, which is still going on over a decade. None of these wars have had a declaration of war, and the Iraqi war was we were actually told that they're building weapons of mass destruction. It's to our own national interest. We have to go in and we have to take care of this. And of course, that came we found out later that this wasn't true.
Mm-hmm.
But it was one. It was the president on his own decision and initiative. I don't know who was behind him, but he's the one that had to say, thrust us into that war, and look how many hundreds of thousands of collateral damage in Iraq. You had, I don't remember how many thousands there were that died. Hundreds of thousands were wounded, I mean seriously maimed,
mm-hmm,
with
mm-hmm,
IEDs blowing limbs off and so forth. And then you had, that was in Iraq, in Afghanistan. By the way, when Barack Obama was running for president, he promised one of the first things he's going to do is get us out of Afghanistan.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
Well, what is it, over 5 years later,
sure.
Still there, still going on. And the problem is, this is a great point to illustrate what happens when you start to veer off course on the Constitution.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
This is all the mainly the lives that were lost, the people that are permanently disfigured and wounded and will suffer the rest of their life for going into this war. And the national treasure, what is it? Is it in the trillions yet of how much we poured into these wars? I would assume that.
Oh, I would imagine so, but I don't know the figure, but I would imagine so.
Yeah, I mean, a tremendous amount of treasure has been gone into this. Now, recently we were talking about going into Syria, and this was just an odd thing that occurred. Up to all the presidents, most of them don't hesitate to go into these incursions. Our president didn't when he went into Libya, and then he's going to go into Syria. Remember, we went in Somalia because of the...
Oh, absolutely.
I mean, they show these poor, hungry people, and the media just has... They're the puppeteers. They manipulate the people with pictures and images and what they say. So we go into Somalia. That was a disaster in order to feed the people. And we go in just to be able to help them feed the starving children. And then it always morphs into taking care of the government, helping the people. And see, we have no constitutional mandate to do any of these
yes.
things. We went into... in Desert Storm, we went in to help Kuwait from Iraq. There's things that are going
yeah.
on all over the world.
Mm-hmm.
But the administrations pick and chooses for their own either personal or party interests to go into war to because of the pressures that are put on them, rather than In Iraq, you had, I don't know, some people say, well, we went in there for oil. Some people say it was just a personal agenda of the president. Whatever it was,
mm-hmm.
There was no declaration of war, which would have kept
Absolutely.
And curtailed that from happening.
Yes.
And then it gets into nation building, and we're still, supposedly we pulled out, but we still have our interests there. And what happens as soon as we pull out? It goes back exactly to what it was before.
Yeah.
And they ignore places like the Sudan, where hundreds of thousands of Christians
yeah.
are butchered, and where a war has been going on for so long. Why don't we go to war with them?
Mm-hmm.
I mean, why if we're going to go in these other places, why not there? They ignore those as if they hadn't even happened. That's just an example. All mm-hmm. over the world, there are countries oppressing others and slaughter. It is my opinion that the Constitution tells us we're supposed to protect our own nation and not get into nation building and not be the global cops of the world. And when we get into this, we get into the shape that we're in now. And when Obama said he's going, the latest one, well, there was some poisonous gas that were killing people
mm-hmm.
in Syria. And so... our president said there was a red line, and by golly, he's going to have to keep his red line, so we're going into Syria.
Mm-hmm.
And they say, well, this is just a temporary incursion. We're just going in there to punish him. Well,
mm-hmm.
what right do we have to punish any leader of another country. Mm-hmm. Whether he's a dictator or not, our job is not to go punish people like that.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
But they said, okay, we're going in there just to punish him, and then we'll be out. And the people were saying, hey, you're talking about the Middle East. This is a powder keg. You don't know what kind of this action might wind up in World War III. And so the president finally says, okay, well, I'm going to go to the Congress. But even then, he says, I'm going to go to the Congress, but I don't need to. I don't have to. I have the right to.
Yeah.
And right then, he should have been impeached. Hey, you don't have the right to take us to war.
Mm-hmm.
And they said, well, it's not a war. It's just an incursion. And they use these names, these word games to make it think that it's not a war. It's, what is it when you have missiles going in, you have troops, they say, I promise there won't be any boots on the ground. That's the latest, boots
on
the
ground.
Yeah,
that's right. Yeah.
I believe that as far as I can slobber. Nothing like that. Nothing they say means anything because they've shown that they're just liars.
Mm-hmm.
They're just, well, I'll get off my rant here.
No. The dumbing down of our people over the last century has resulted in these intrusions and incursions into our Constitution that nobody, generally speaking, is saying anything about. And the thought that came to my mind when you were looking at how much money had been spent on these wars, maybe $1 trillion, the thought that came to my mind is this same dumbed-down population. If you went out on the street with a microphone and said, how many zeros are there in a trillion? It would be interesting to know how many people would know how many zeros there are in a trillion. And many years ago, I remember a cartoon where Charlie Brown was asked, what comes after a trillion? And he stopped and thought for a minute, and he said, maybe cow-trillion. You know, it's like he didn't know, but it was a cow-trillion. So anyway, back to you, sir.
By the way, I think it's a quadrillion, isn't it?
It's something like that.
And then after that, the quintillion.
Yeah, that's right, yeah.
Well, anyhow. What I'm trying to explain is the horrible consequences of what happens when we veer off away from the Constitution. It always gets back to the people because the people allow this to happen.
Yes.
And they keep voting in the same people that ignore the Constitution,
mm-hmm.
that go into these foreign wars that cost us the lives of our soldiers. And if we had the money back that we had spent on these wars, the war in Vietnam and in Iraq and Desert Storm and Afghanistan, and there's several others,
mm-hmm.
minor ones that
sure.
I hadn't even mentioned, but it would be completely different. And I think that if you don't know the Declaration of Independence, if you don't know what's in the Constitution, if you don't know what's in the Bill of Rights, if you don't know what's in the Bible,
yeah.
then you are going to fall prey to these unconscionable
mm-hmm.
Miscreants who are in the media,
mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
Because they actually mold and shape the thinking of the people because the people can't think for themselves.
Mm-hmm.
And I think the way out of this is the same way for a person, whether it's spiritual or whether it has to do with politics or anything else. You've got to have knowledge. Apart from knowledge, you can't even start in the right direction. You don't even know where the ballpark is, much less being
yeah.
in the ball game.
Yeah, that's right.
And that's why I'm thinking that we have to be knowledgeable. And you asked me earlier one of the motivations why I wrote this book, and this is why. Because the people are essentially abysmally ignorant of the very fundamentals of our government, of the principles of the Bible. They don't have them. They're too busy watching TV and being manipulated by everyone, and that's why I would implore all the people who are listening or who will be listening, if they understand these principles that we're espousing
mm-hmm,
here,
mm-hmm.
for them to pass it on to others, to talk to other people about it so they can become knowledgeable as well, because apart from that knowledge, we're nothing but sheep, we're nothing but slaves.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. Amen.
Okay, well,
Hey, I'm going to give you a charismatic, hey, amen, hallelujah, Jesus, praise. Sure enough, even waved my hands a little bit, Mike. Yeah.
Well, I'm just trying to, these principles and these issues that we're covering, that Dr. Ramsey was applauding how wonderful things were then, are deplorable now. We don't have those things anymore. And now, what are we're floundering, we're confused, we're in a tremendous pit. I don't know how we're going to get out of it apart from the grace of God. And if the people remain ignorant and apathetic, we're toast, we're done.
I think the answer right now, I know what needs to take place. At least I think it is. I talked about the cultural change, the educational change, and the structural change. But to bring that about, I don't know that we have what it's going to take to bring it about. So I think the solution is the rapture.
Well, anybody that knows anything about the Bible would recognize that there is only one person in the universe that can straighten this whole thing out, and he's going to be coming soon. And when he does, he's going to take us out of here, and then the world will be thrust into the worst time there ever was or ever will be.
Yep, that's
and when
right.
he comes back at the second advent, he's going to sort everything out.
Yep.
And there's not going to be any negotiations.
That's right. Oh,
he's
yeah.
He's not coming back to negotiate. He's coming back to set things straight.
Oh.
And what a wonderful time that's going to be.
Isn't that right? Oh, isn't that right? Oh, yeah.
We'll be following him and watching him take care of business in a big way.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, we're coming back with him, right? Is that right?
Absolutely. We're going to be following him.
Yeah.
And, you know, I kind of have the urge, you know, I want to fight with him, but we don't even have to. He's going to take care of himself.
Yes, exactly right.
And that's part of our hope. That's what we're our confidence that
in
the meantime we are languishing in a world of sin and hate and suffering and just deplorable things. But what helps us to get through these? One of the things that helps us to endure it and is the confidence and hope that, well, it's going to be taken care of. It might not be taken care of in our time here on earth, but he is definitely going to take care of it. And all those that are persecuting and persecuting the innocent and all the, they're going to pay. They're all going to get there.
Well, the interesting thing about that, what you just said about fighting, our fight is now. His fight's going to be later.
That's right. In the meantime, we just can't go blank. I mean, we have our job to do, and I see your job and my job. One of the most important jobs we have is to impart knowledge to the people.
Yes.
Actually, it's for believers, the Holy Spirit that really is their mentor that takes these principles and transfers it into their soul as epinosis knowledge.
Mm-hmm, absolutely.
And that's what changes their thinking, and that's what really makes the difference. But we're just the mouthpiece, and this is what I think we're trying to do today, right now, is to make the issues clear and give the people options for them to see that they don't have to be slaves. They don't have to be persecuted. They do have rights that God gave them, and they have the opportunity, at least still right now, to stand up and say, "We will not have this," and start speaking out to others. See, everybody has contact with people in their family, their friends, their acquaintances, and until people start talking about this and having dialogue with others, I think we're just going to stay on this course, spiraling further down into degeneracy.
You know, Mike, we're just about out of time, but in wrapping this up, I like what you just said in terms of the man in the pew, the common, ordinary guy out here like you and me. It's a matter of talking. It's not a matter of getting up and taking a gun. It's not a matter of running for Congress. But it's a matter of educating people in our periphery. So what we need to do is be talking about this and giving the truth about all that's going on at this point in time. Would you agree with that?
Absolutely. It's a lot like giving the gospel. First of all, you have to know what the gospel is.
Mm-hmm.
And once you accept the gospel, it becomes part of who you are. that's not the end. What we're required to do is go out and tell other people, give them the good news.
Yes, yes.
And that's what we're trying to do here, is give them the good news. God hasn't required us to submit to tyranny.
Absolutely. No, he's not. And so why don't you wrap this show, I tell you what, this is one of these cases now where to get through chapter 2, before we get to, it's probably going to take right after about 6 weeks after the rapture to get done with this. Okay.
Well, I don't know about the time, but I think every time I give a message, mm-hmm. it's not the amount of time you spend, it's how much content you cover.
Yes, absolutely.
I'm sorry, I said that wrong. It's not how many chapters or verses that you
sure.
get through.
Mm-hmm.
It's the content of what you're giving, and sometimes you have to go at a snail's pace to get it all.
Absolutely. Well, listen, why don't you just go and wrap it up and just say just wrap it up by saying anything you want to say. We'll close this out and be back again next Monday.
Okay. Well, again, I appreciate all those who have logged on and are listening to this. I hope that it's been helpful and beneficial to you.
Mm-hmm.
And now we all have the responsibility to carry on the message and give it to other people.
Mm-hmm.
And I hope that you'll look for opportunities to, if nothing else, tell someone, you know, I was listening to the Dr. Jim show, and they had some really good things that they were discussing, and just bring up the issues and start talking about it. You don't have to get on a soapbox. Just bring up the issues, see what they think, and just start having dialogue, and I think that will go a long way to in the right direction that we need to go.
Okay, pal. Well, thank you so much for being with us today, and we'll see you again next Monday if the creek doesn't rise.
Thanks a lot for the opportunity of being here, Dr. Jim.
Okay, buddy. Bye-bye now.
Bye-bye.
Walked this earth a long time ago. He came to offer us life and take us home. Silly man said no. He did the earth walk down by the Sea of Galilee, up to that old rugged cross where God laid down his life.
Okay, folks, I've just closed down my recording, and Mr. Ed Halsband will have this up on the Internet on iTunes sometime soon, and it'll be available there for download and for listening again if you desire. I'll take about 30 seconds of time to wait before I close out my encoder. And we'll see you again in about an hour and 10 minutes, about an hour and 13 minutes. We'll have IQ Al-Razuli on with us at that point in time. So tune back in again if you have time. Tune back in again at 11:15. He normally calls me a little early, so sometimes maybe around 11:10, 11:12, something like that. And we may start a moment or two early, but if you want to hear him, we'll be talking about Islam and the problems with Islam as it tries to bring us under its banner. So back again in about an hour and 13.